I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan. This episode of Sascapes is sponsored by the Saskatchewan Association of Theatre Professionals, supporting Saskatchewan's performing arts and artists and promoting Saskatchewan's talent across Canada and around the world. Yvette Nolan is a playwright, director, and dramaturge. Her body of work is impressive. And during the time I spent chatting with Yvette, it was clear to me that she has passion. A passion for storytelling, for opera, for Shakespeare, for Indigenous theater. She has a desire to give voice to the marginalized through theater, to explore diversity in casting, to think outside of the box. Yvette's work has been and continues to be collaborative. In fact, I speak with her while she's in Calgary, building a new work from the ground up together with her colleagues. Yvette and I discuss how her relationship with her mother informs the way she moves through life, and the influence on her work. Yvette is driven, she's focused, she's always forward-thinking in her work, and through it all, she's filled with the spirit of generosity and gratitude. And I happen to know that she has a great fondness for her coffee pot, and were it not for the pandemic, well, I might have had a chat with Yvette while she's sitting in her favorite coffee joint. But these are COVID times, and so we cope the best we can under the new normal. Welcome to episode 96 of Sascapes. This is Yvette Nolan. Yvette Nolan, thank you for joining me all the way from Calgary. It's good to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm glad that you're in Calgary. I'm glad that you're working. I'm insanely jealous, but I am thrilled that a colleague is working and thriving and rehearsing in live theater. And it just gives me hope that we will rise against the adversity of the pandemic. But then I was thinking, well, we're artists, and pre-COVID, that's kind of the way we roll generally, right?
That's right. We rise again, as they say. It is strange being in, I mean, the protocols are so intense in order to work in the room. And this is like the third time I've worked in a room with human beings since the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. And these, because this is opera and we're making a new opera, it's the protocols are even more stringent because of singing, of course. And so it is really an adventure. It is good that we are resilient as artists because this could be a little bit crazy making.
Yeah. Are you all wearing masks and things while you're singing? I mean, I guess you pretty much have to.
Yeah. We all wear masks, all the time, except at lunch when we sit far, we go into the big, big room and we sit far away from each other and we eat. That's the only time we unmask inside the building. But it's more than that. There are these things, these air purifiers that are called air snipers. And that's so violent that I've renamed ours Puff and the big one downstairs Smog. But they're air purifiers that run. We do 45 minutes in the room and then we leave the room and we run the air purifier for 10 minutes before we come back in. And as far as singing goes, the rule is there can only be two people in a room when they're singing. One is the singer and the other is, you know, could be the repetiteur, could be the director, could be the librettist, but it can only be two people in the room. One is the singer. So it's hard to make an opera in that way because generally they're about people singing together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll talk a little bit later on about what this work is. Yeah, I'm glad that you're able to make it work and thrilled that you were able to travel. You probably had to do some kind of quarantine period when you first got there.
Did not quarantine because there was no quarantine and there still is none between Saskatchewan and Alberta.
Right.
Coming this way. I think the rules may have changed since I got here, not in Alberta. They're reducing the rules here. We are still behaving as if we're being very, very careful because nobody wants this thing, right? Nobody wants COVID. So we didn't quarantine, but we don't have any interaction with any other human beings. We're in our rooms, our hotel rooms. We walk to the theater. We're in the theater masked. We walk home. We're in our rooms. It can be a little bit lonely.
Have you found that in general? How's your pandemic been in general? Has it been fairly more isolating than life might have been for you previously?
I have a partner. And he is, and so, of course, he works for the government. So he was sent home at the beginning of the pandemic. So the two of us have been together. And I'm very, very grateful for that because I know a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues who were alone, like no partner, no family, not even a cat. And so it's been great to have Philip in my house with me. And then, it has been like, who knew the apocalypse was going to be this busy? Like we Zoom from meeting to meeting to meeting. So we've spent a lot of time with a lot of people in a lot of places on the internet, of course. So my pandemic has been busy and productive. And I am so grateful for all of that.
So you didn't hit that period when you just thought, every day feels like Groundhog Day, I'm just not feeling creative. You kept on going.
I have a lot of things on my plate at any given time. And so I took advantage of the pause to get a lot of things off my plate. And of course, the pandemic happened, then Black Lives Matter happened, then the neo-civil rights movement rose again, speaking of We Rise Again, and then things got really busy in that other kind of work, like the advocacy work and the sharing work and the teaching work, and that has been keeping a lot of us very busy as well, talking about, because this is the change moment for a lot of institutions, for a lot of theaters and opera companies and boards of directors, which is where my research is. And so there's been a lot of talking going on as well about, what happens on the other end of the pandemic. And like you, I am so hopeful that we will come out of this and once again be able to gather. But I don't think we're going back to the old model of theater. I don't think we can. I think too many things have changed.
Do you think not going back to the old model might actually be a blessing in disguise?
I absolutely do. I think we as a society have gotten away from the purpose of theater in sort of our chasing something else, which is like some other idea of success, which is about money and bums in seats. And I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think it's sustainable anymore, certainly as we head into, whatever we're coming through to, everything has to change because climate change, because civil rights, because equity, like all of these things demand change. And the kind of theater that we were making was dependent on a kind of a numbness, It was like an anesthetized population that believed that theater was just for entertainment. And I don't think that is even possible anymore. I don't mean it has to be didactic,
right?
Or, you know, or propagandist, but I do think that as the resources shrink, and they're going to shrink because we can't have, you know, 500 or 1,000 people in a room together anymore. We're not going back to that. I really don't think that a lot of the people who were willing to go and sit like that are going to be willing, even in the next year, even in the next 2 years, even in the next 3 years. We're going to start slow. We're going to gather in smaller groups, like in 30s and 50s and 100. And that means we're going to have to be more mindful about what kind of theater we're presenting.
I'm amazed and awestruck and inspired every day at the way artists have found, the way artists have recreated their traditional mode of performing, interacting with fellow artists, particularly when you look at the online content, the collaborative work that's going on that is incredible, and the ingenious technology behind making these things come together. I think it's really forced us to interact in a way that we may have been rather complacent about doing up until the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
I mean, I look at some of the Zoom content, you know, the vocal work people are doing together, the instrumental work people are doing together, and how it's all edited together. It's brilliant. It's bringing people together around the world that would never have had contact with each other.
Absolutely. And I don't think we're ever going back. Like, I don't think it's going to replace theater, but I don't think that we're ever going back to just people being in a room together. And so I think it's like this new thing, right? Like the thing that people are creating together. But it's also, you know, we have to be careful about the privilege of technology. Like, you and I started this conversation being challenged by the technology of just telephones,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And not everybody has the kind of internet that you need to do that kind of work. Not everybody has, some communities don't have that kind of internet. I mean, the Calgary Opera Room where I'm working, the internet sucks, and we're in downtown Calgary.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, I think we have to be mindful of who has, and computers, right? Like, in order to access these things, you actually need computers. And the more fantastic the technology gets, the more people need to have better equipment and to keep up. So I don't want to create this other new sort of capitalist sort of subsystem for technology just so artists can work together. I want to be sure that, you know, a kid in northern Manitoba has access to art and has access to a way of making art. And I think more makes more. So I think this new way that we're making theater together on the internet is opening one door, but it doesn't close the door to being in a room together with people.
Oh, absolutely. And nothing for me will replace live theater. And I know it's going to take a while to get bums back in seats, but there is, as I was having a long philosophical conversation with Henry Wolfe two episodes ago, we were talking about live theater. There is this palpable energy exchange between audience and performer in live theater that you can't replicate with technology. It's the gift of live theater, and I hope that we do get enough bums back in seats so that audiences can feel that and artists can feel that and participate. It's a participatory event between performer and an audience member, which can't be recreated online.
No, it can't be. And we know that from, you know, we spend however many hours on the Zoom, and we're exhausted afterwards because we're just putting in and we're not getting back.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, that actual connection is missing. Like, for one thing, you can't look into people's eyes because the camera, where the camera is and where the, how the everybody is looking. So it's really fatiguing, that kind of work. And for actors, for performers, they're putting out and not receiving back anything, like the breath, the gasps, the applause, just the energy of being in a room together. So I know that live theater is not going to die. I know that, you know, last summer, some theater, we pivoted really quickly to do a moving theatrical adventure because we could no longer do our, you know, the theater in the park thing that we normally do because we weren't allowed to gather. So instead we made a parade that was not a parade because that would have been against the law, but a traveling theater piece that moved through neighborhoods, and people were so overjoyed to see us. Even if they only saw like 2 minutes of the 20-minute parade, the joy of being, of seeing something live that was spectacular and joyful and musical was just so regenerating for us all. It was the thing that we miss about live theater.
So great. It's so good to hear. I want to go back in time now in your life, because one of the things that I'm curious about with all people, and artists included, is what informed them growing up, and the people they interacted with, the people who raised them. All of those influences inform the person they are today and the way they work in the arts, I feel. So I've done some reading on you, so I have a little bit of information. I know that you were born in PA originally. Yeah. And I was curious about the connection between your father and your mother. I know that your father came here from Ireland, and your mom was Algonquin, which is an interesting combination in and of itself. And your dad was a teacher at the penitentiary, in the residential school system. He was a math teacher, and your mom was his student, right?
That's correct.
So
all of that is correct. My origin story.
Yeah. Well, something that I read in that origin story, which really is appropriate to talk about now because of what we've been talking about with the pandemic, about change and social change. You had mentioned that both of your parents were anxious for change based on where they'd come from. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. My parents, as you noted, my dad was my mom's math teacher in residential school, and the nuns gave them a wedding, and then we moved around, and that's why we were in PA when I was born, because my dad was teaching at the penitentiary. He couldn't get a job at his profession at the beginning here in Canada. He was a draftsman. When he finally got that job as a draftsman, it was in Winnipeg, and we moved to Winnipeg, and I was 6 years old. And my brother was three. My in-between brother was three. My parents gave me all of the things that they would have loved to have. Mm. So I had piano lessons. I had ballet lessons. I had theater school. I had books. I always had books before we even moved to the city. A book would come in the mail every month. I was an early reader. But my mother, because she was an autodidact a bit, because the education in residential schools wasn't that great. I'm just telling you.
That's an understatement.
they were actually training Indigenous folks to manual labor, and, you know, the boys to sort of farm and labor work, and the women to like housekeeping duties and, you know, laundries and things like that. So, but in spite of that, my mother was addicted to learning. And because she married very young, and had me very young. And so to a certain extent, we grew up together, and we, what she learned, I learned. And she loved words. She was, she had three languages. So her first language was Algonquin, and her second language was French, and her third language was English. And when she died, she was the master, a master of English, and had lost most of her Algonquin and was still fluent in French. But she knew, as my father knew, that power lay in controlling the language. He had been the champion Irish speaker in high school in Ireland, and that was a victory because Irish was outlawed in Ireland for a long time. And my mother had through those three languages, and they were both like hopelessly addicted to English and to the power of English. My father loves Yeats, and poetry. And I used to learn poetry as a child as a gift for my father, like, you know, birthdays and Christmas and stuff. I would learn to recite a poem like John Masefield, "I Must Go Down to the Sea Again, to the Lonely Sea and Sky." And like, I learned poetry. And so, and that was a thing that I recognized was power. So my parents gave me all of those things, which led me to believe that I was going to be an actor. And then, you know, when I finished high school and I was like, I'm going to be an actor. And they're like, no, you're not. This is not a job. This was just to make you a well-rounded human being. You know, please be a lawyer or a doctor or something useful. but I was hooked. I was hooked on theater. And I kicked around for a few years, and then I went back to university. And because my parents had said that, you know, don't put your child in the theater, I did another useful degree in English and French. And, you know, you don't get a lot of jobs with that. But by the time I graduated with my undergrad, I was working. You can't get away from it. If you're a theater rat, and I am a theater rat, there's no getting away from it. So by the time I graduated from university with my undergrad, I was working as a theater rat. I was hanging lights. I was stage managing. I had to defer a final exam. Bless Judy Flynn for letting me, my Victorian's final exam, because I had a gig as a stage manager of a festival. And so I did everything and have done everything to stay in the theater, to work in the theater. Even if it's not like, you know, eventually I became a playwright. Eventually I became a director. Eventually I became a dramaturge. But at the beginning, I was like, I would do anything. I was laying dance floor and hanging lights. And, you know, it's very useful because it informed me about how all of the bits go together. And that nobody's piece is more important than anybody else's piece, whether you're an actor or stage manager, or designer, or the director, or the playwright. It's collaborative, and all of those things have to go together. My parents both wanted change. My father was working class. My mother was Indigenous and suffered from that all of her life, between tuberculosis as a child, residential school, racism, just trying to grow and live. And she never got bitter. She continued to work for change. She continued to believe that we could be whatever we wanted. She was a human rights commissioner. She was an adult educator. When she died, I got a card from her class of English as an additional language students, and with all of their condolences inside. And I thought, isn't that a terrible irony that all of these newcomers to this country were being taught English by an Indigenous woman who had her language taken away from them? But that is also generosity, right? Like, my mother was generous.
Hey, it's Kevin. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the SaaScapes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the SaaScapes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called SaaScapes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When SaaScapes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode. I'm just pausing to take that in. That's quite profound. It's quite something. How was it, and I don't mean to get too personal, but how was it for your mom, do you think, having grown up in residential school, having really been, having really been exposed to the traditional patriarchal structure, was there this feeling of going from, I mean, she married someone older than her, someone who was her teacher. Was that sort of a safety zone for her, having that sort of traditional patriarchal structure within her life? And did that work for her or against her? What are your feelings on that?
Or both. I mean, my mother used to say, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing about everything?
Right.
She married a good man, my father, a Catholic, which was, you know, great. That's why the nuns allowed it, because he was a good Catholic man. He was Irish. They loved each other for sure. And it gave her the opportunity to have a stable family life, to have children, me and my two brothers, to have continue learning things. It started, the marriage eventually ended because my mother didn't want to stop learning and my father wanted a pretty traditional stay-at-home life. And that was the beginning of the end. But everything has its season, and I think those relationships do as well. I think for my mother to continue to keep growing and self-actualizing, she had to leave the marriage because my father didn't want her to become more than what she was when he met her. And she was 16, you're not the same person 15 years after you're 16. Like there's a big change. And so I think that was inevitable. I don't think my mother regretted any of it. I think she was the one who taught me that we take everything with us and go forward. She would never have had the opportunities that she had if she had gone back to her reserve. Plus, she was already would have been, it's so hard to go back to communities after you've been away for that long. Like she was taken when she was 7 and she graduated when she was 16. And that's a long time. Again, another lifetime, right? And she would never have regretted having us, but certainly the responsibility for me, what I felt when she died was, and what people told me when they sent me condolences was, she goes on in you. And we know that in Indigenous worldview that we are here because of what our ancestors did, and that's a responsibility. And so I have always been aware of that responsibility. But when my mother died, I was like, okay, time to, I got to step up because everything my mother did has led me to this moment.
She gave birth to you when she was 17. That's not really a huge gap between a child and a mother. I mean, I think my oldest brother is 15 years older than I am. So theoretically, there could be a 17-year gap between siblings. Was your mom a mother, a friend, a sibling? How did it feel for you growing up, or all three?
Well, that's a great question. She always said that I was her best friend, and that's partly because we lived in because we were so close in age, because we lived in isolated communities until we moved to the city, because, you know, so many reasons. She was my friend. Sometimes I wish she were more of my mother and less of a friend, but that's, you know, we, whatever, if wishes were horses. My brothers, one of my brothers is 3 years younger than me, and the other is 8 years younger. And so they had more of a mother, but they also had a shorter time in the family unit because my parents split when I was 16. It is why I became so, like, so addicted to words and to learning, because my mother was addicted to words and to learning. And at that time, like, there's, you know, kind of a sort of a notorious story about my first Shakespeare, which was Julius Caesar, which was a Stratford production that was recorded and broadcast on the CBC. And so we watched it, my mother and I, and we were, you know, I was a toddler and she was, you know, maybe 20. and my father would come home and she would quiz me for my father's benefit. And she said, "What did we do today, Vet?" And I said, "We watched a play." And she's like, "What was the play?" I said, "Julius Caesar." She said, "And what happened in the play?" And I said, "His friends killed him." And she said, "And what did he say when his friends killed him?" And I said, "Tee-hee, Brutus." And that was my first Shakespeare, was Julius Caesar. And that particular Stratford production, I believe Bruno Gerussi was in it.
Wow. Yeah.
And of course, it became, this is how I thought I was going to be an actor. Like, it was all performative, right? Like, I was learning these things and then regurgitating them, because to teach is to learn twice. Mm-hmm. And so this is to show my father what I had learned and what my mother had learned. Of course, she knew it was not Tee-hee, Brutus, but it too, Brute.
Yeah. But you took creative license and made it your own thing.
Absolutely. And then, you know, like, however many years later, actually, when my mother died, we were in the process of working on an adaptation of Julius Caesar at Native Earth Performing Arts, an all-Indigenous adaptation that we produced the year after my mother died. And so on the one hand, I'm sorry she didn't get to see it, because there's a full circle for you. And on the other hand, it was an honoring of her that, you know, we were working on that when she died.
Is that why you have such a, I know that you don't restrict yourself to one genre of theater, but you do have a particular attraction to opera, yes?
Oh, yes. Yes, opera. I mean, my mother loved opera. She loved opera. I'm like, what kind of an Indian likes opera?
Yeah.
She loved the grandness of it, and she loved the music. She loved it. She took me, of course, to my first opera, which was Madame Butterfly, which is problematic, a problematic story for any number of reasons. Yeah. But, you know, we went, I cried. I saw myself, I was trouble, right? Like, there's Madame Butterfly and Pinkerton, and they have the child Trouble, and Trouble is Trouble. And I was like, wow, I totally understand why she was interested in this story. And yeah, she loved opera, and she loved Saturday afternoons at the opera. It was always on. And my partner, when we were in Toronto, Philip was doing a Dora jury, and he would get the opera tickets. It was the big general jury, and he'd be like, "Do you want to go see this?" And I'd be like, "No, can you take my mom?" So he took Helen to the operas, and that was a great thing. Like, you know, it's that crazy thing of, like, what are the expectations of our life are, and who would have expected this Algonquin woman from a reserve in Quebec to be going to see the Canadian Opera Company in Toronto, not as a stunt, but because she truly loved it.
not as a stunt. What would the stunt have looked like?
Well, okay, so here's an instant of an instance. When we were living in Winnipeg, I was working at MTC, and they did a stunt casting of Hamlet. Keanu Reeves played Hamlet.
I remember that.
And he came to Winnipeg. Do you remember this? He came to Winnipeg to do Hamlet.
Yeah.
And on opening night, so here's a series of three stunts. On opening night, it was, you know, you had to buy an entire subscription in order to get tickets to see it, which was like, it floated NTC for years, I am sure. But because I was working there, I had tickets. And one of the stunts that they did in the marketing department was, as people were walking into the theater, they gave them Coles notes for Hamlet. And the third part of the stunt is, as my mother walked in the door, my mother, this small Indigenous woman, walked in the door in her fancy duds, carrying her, you know, her bag and the Coles notes they had just given her for Hamlet. The press took a photograph and they put it in the paper.
Oh.
Hmm. So there's the triple stunt, right? A, Keanu Reeves. B, Coles notes. C, Indigenous woman.
How did she feel about that?
She thought it was funny. And she thought she was a star. She's like, she was always, take my picture. But she also knew. I mean, she knew she was very, very smart, and she knew what they were doing. And she knew when they took her picture that she would be the one in the paper because of that stunt. So there is that about, you know, it's like when we went to see Going Home Star, the ballet by the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. They had all kinds of Indigenous folks coming to the ballet. And that was like treated like a stunt, because it's like, Indigenous people don't go to ballet. Well, I was in the ballet from the time I was 6 until 14, and I'm Indigenous. You know, there's just like, these are about the breaking of expectations. And my mother knew when they took her picture that people would see that, but she knew it's a double-edged sword, right? Like, people would see it and be like, oh, look at the Indian with the Coles notes going to see Hamlet. But it's also like, oh, there's an Indigenous person going to MTC, the big theater, the big regional theater. And she's all dressed up, like, you know, like in her fancy duds.
I suppose the only way to make a stunt pay off is that, or no, that's not the way to say it. I suppose if a quote-unquote stunt leads to dialogue, then so be it, and that's mission accomplished?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And, you know, this is something that Indigenous artists have been dealing with, and Black artists, like people of color, we've all been dealing with this for a long time. It is not a surprise. We've been cast in things because we are BIPOC, right? Because we're Black or Indigenous or people of color. So what do? Not take the job because you know they're casting you, it's stunt casting? Or do you take the job and prove you can do the work? And then you've opened a door and you're holding the door open. It's like, there's been a lot of that over the past 20 years. There's been a lot. We know it's happening right now, even as we're having these discussions about the neo-civil rights movement. We are being invited onto boards. I had a meeting with a young woman this morning who was like, I've been invited onto 3 boards since this started. And I'm like, you have to be careful, because do they want you on their board because they want to make change? And they recognize that you as an Indigenous woman are going to help them with that? Or do they want you on your board because it makes them look like they're making change? And she's like, I have turned all 3 of them down. So we are aware of this, right? But in this moment where change, in this change moment, we have a little bit more power to You know, it's like this opera that I'm working on here. Calgary Opera is actually digging in. They've really made room for us. They're really trying to learn. This project is well-resourced, this development project. We were invited in because they recognize their whiteness and their privilege, and because they have a relationship with Marion Newman, who is kind of our leader, our fearless leader in this project. And we've had an ongoing communication with them about what it means for us to come into their house and work. And they've been great. It's been really a good experience, but it's been a good experience because it's not a stunt, because they want to change. And part of the way they change is by changing. And it's not a stunt in a bunch of ways, because there's no audience for this, right? Like, this is all development work. So right now, this is just the work. So we're developing a piece. The opera is developing a way of working with others. And we're hoping that this all pays off in the future.
Yes, I've been there with two Canadian opera premieres. And I miss that period. I miss that year of no audience, just workshopping and originating a role. And it's just as good as a good piece of dark chocolate. That part of the process is golden, and it influences the actual performance itself when it gets in front of an audience for so many ways. I could talk about, you know, for 2 hours about how that work on the floor for that long period of time really informs the success of a piece from the artist's perspective. But this is when adjectives elude me, because it's wonderfully self-indulgent and informative work, and it's the best. It's the best to explore places you would never have gone before. It's the best place to screw up. It's Disneyland. That's what it is. It's like Disneyland, that whole process. This work that you're involved with, you're writing the libretto. Is this the post-apocalyptic opera that you're writing with composer Tim Brady from Montreal?
Nope. That is a different opera that I'm writing with Tim Brady. No, that one is in the middle of things, which is fine. He has pieces of the libretto, and I'm working on it. But the thing that happened with that opera, that's the Sofia opera, is like, I can't keep up with the technology it's about artificial intelligence and human beings post-apocalyptic. And every day there's something new about artificial intelligence. So that is part of that joy of that libretto. No, this one is about, we're creating together. I am nominally the librettist, and Marion and I are at this point co-directing but because we're trying to create a new way of working, it's very non-hierarchical. Everyone in the room brings everything to the room. So there's Marion, who is the mezzo, but also kind of the producer who got us into this, but also kind of the dramaturge. I'm the librettist. There's two composers, Ian Cousson, who's Métis, and Parmila Attariwala, who is Canadian but Punjabi by birth. She's born here, but her parents are Punjabi by birth. And Michelle Lafferty and Melody Courage, who are two Indigenous opera singers. And Asita Tenakun, who's a tenor originally from Sri Lanka, now a Canadian citizen. All in the room together, all participating in the creation of this. And so the thing that you talk about, like that, the development time, and it's even more heightened because we are doing this together. It's not like I've written a libretto and it's gone to the composers and they're composing something. It's like we're all participating in this. We read the libretto and people are inserting sounds and ideas, and, you know, Ian goes away and composes something, and then he comes back, and then Parmila improvises on top of it. And it's so great. And, you know, once I get off this call with you, I'm going to finish a scene that I'm working on, because we've been pushing our way towards the end of the libretto.
In a nutshell, what's the story? Is there an actual title or a working title?
It's called Namwayut, N-A-M, Namwayut, W-A-Y-U-T, which means, in Marian's language, all my relations. And what it is about is how knowledge is disseminated, and how it's a woman who starts in kind of a pre-contact time and ends up in this time with the knowledge of her ancestors, with the knowledge of nature, in an attempt to save us from ourselves, an attempt to counteract the greed and excess that has led us to the place we're at, on the precipice of, you know, climate change that is going to destroy us. So she starts in one time period. She travels through time. Geez, everything I write seems to be post-apocalyptic. And she arrives in a moment just before this time that we're in, with a message, which is about how all my relations, like how everything is connected, how we are all connected. And if it's the right moment, if it is the change moment, that the world can hear it and we can pull back from the precipice.
In your collaborative work, in your, well, you said something interesting. You said what was the word you actually used regarding when I asked you if you were a librettist? You said you were a librettist in part, meaning that it's because it's collaborative, a nominal. Yes. So you're a nominal librettist because you're working collaboratively with the others, as opposed to going in and saying, this is fixed on the page, do it.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. And we read it, you know, the work, we came into the room with 14 libretti pages, and we're up to about 21 pages now after a week of work. But as you know, libretti are like skinny because the music takes up a lot of space. But we read it, and then the singers are like, what if this happened? What if that happens? This makes me think about that. Or what is, you know, what does this mean? And so that just keeps feeding into it, which is why, you know, Marian and I walking home last night, and she's like, so what do we call you? And I'm like, I don't mind being called scribe. And she's like, well, no, you're the librettist, because you're the one who's pulling all the ideas together. But it's not just my ideas, right? Like, even the idea that when we started the project, Marian and I sat on the Zoom and just jammed about what kind of story we would want to tell in this day and age. And we agreed we don't want to do trauma. We don't want to do, like, we don't want to do teaching. We don't want to be didactic. So, you know, we started talking about what do we want to say? What do we want to be seen to be singing in this day and age? And so it had to be hopeful, and it had to be, in a large way, it's mythological, like we're myth-making, because our heroine at the end becomes a tree that connects everything.
Here's a question for you. With scripts that you have written that are basically complete, that you turn over to a theater to produce, I'm assuming that that's happened in your life.
Mm-hmm.
What does it feel like as a director when you're not the dramaturge? What does it feel like a director to hand a script over and step aside and sit in the back row of a theater while they're rehearsing and cringe and watch your words interpreted in ways that perhaps you had not intended? Is that both interesting, enlightening, and excruciating for you?
It is not really excruciating, because I waited a long time for that privilege to be able to hand over a script to someone and see it made. see it brought to life. Because for a long time, I produced my own work. I directed my own work, like the premieres of it. So there is something really freeing about handing it over to someone else. And then you find out, like, how good you are. Then you find out, like, if that's really what, if you got it, right? Oh, that's not what I meant. I mean, fortunately, when I do that, I'm in the room for the process, or at least the beginning of the process, and I'm able to fix the things that aren't working. And I'm very, the older I get, the longer I do this, the more flexible I become, to the point where some of the stuff that I'm writing now, very often I write in spaces or stage directions that are kind of improvising. Like, it's like, this is a placeholder. This could happen, or this could happen, or this could happen. That gives room to all the other creatives to make something. So the unplugging, there are those kinds of scenes. They're called scenes, but they're like passage of time. This could be done with lights or sound or movement or whatever. So it leaves a lot of space for the director and her team to make something in there. So I'm not really prescriptive, especially now. And I was just talking to another young artist this morning who's looking at doing Annie Mae's Movement, which was an early play of mine, like 96, I think. And she was asking about, it's always been done as a two-hander, but she was talking about bringing in a third performer to take over one of the roles. And I'm like, that would be so fantastic. Go ahead. Like I've become way more, you know, inclusive of everybody else's. And because I know this, because as a director, like, the more brains in the room, like, why would I try to be doing all, holding all of that when there's all these other creative people in the room? Because more makes more. Like, what we can do is not just like seven times my brain. It's like 49 times my brain, because if we're all jamming off each other's work, then we're making something that is really, truly collaborative and really, truly bigger than anything I could have thought up myself. And I feel that way when I hand over a script to, you know, I don't hand it over to just anyone, but I don't think I've yet seen a production that I've gone, oh, no, that's not what I meant at all. Mm-hmm. Because I'm hoping that the intent is in the dialogue, and that they've chosen the script because it spoke to them. You know, it's kind of its own sort of foolproof thing in that way. And I talk to people all the time. I've got, there's a group in the States who are doing my adaptation of The Birds right now. And he reached out to me and said, you know, I want to do this and I want to do that. And is it okay if I do this? And I was like, absolutely, you go. And I had a couple of meetings with him because he was nervous about, you know, it's a white school, an all white population. But I'm like, it's The Birds. It's about birds. Like, don't worry about the indigenous stuff. Like, just, you know, be creative. And he used to be in Blue Man Group. Mm. So he knows all about, like, that kind of spectacle. And I mean, theater's so metaphorical, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, don't worry about it. Like, everything means something else anyway in the theater.
Can you talk a bit about some of your work that has gone to film and the journey of going into that particular genre of film versus keeping it live on stage?
Well, the most recent piece was Catharsis, which Tom Morgan Jones at Prairie Theater Exchange commissioned as a piece of theater for film. So I knew that I was writing a piece of theater for an empty theater and one performer, but I also knew that it was moving to film, that it was going to be broadcast in a film form. So there was a big, you know, there's a big leap of trust in that because I'm not a filmmaker. But we, you know, Tom assembled the team very, very carefully, and Sam did a great job with it. And that was satisfying to see that piece, because it was still a love letter to the theater. the other sort of film piece that I did was, again, it's who you get into, you know, partnership with, was a common experience that I made with Shane Belcourt, Métis filmmaker, which was about a piece of mine called Dear Mr. Buchwald that was about my mother's residential school settlement. And in the end, the script that we made was so different from the theater piece that it wasn't even the same animal, really. And that was great, too. Like, it was still the essence, the idea that I was writing about for the theater was still there in the film that Shane and I made. And I was just, you know, involved in every part of that. And I think it would be different if, you know, if I, and I don't know that I ever would just like sort of sign away my rights to something and be like, you go and do it. I think I need to protect the integrity of whatever the thing is. And certainly that depends on who your partners are.
So the camera captures emotion and energy very differently than when it is expressed live in a room to an audience. You have to, and it's an art that still drives me crazy and I'm still trying to learn, but you have to tone the dynamic of your emotion down without dumbing down the actual feeling, because the camera lens is more intimate than live theater. So how do you navigate that with your work? How does it appear on film to you? Does it feel like it's too big for the camera lens?
Well, it's such an interesting question, because, I mean, the big difference for me, and I've also found this in directing during the pandemic to broadcast, like directing for live cast, is when I'm directing a piece, I'm directing the entire space. But when you go to broadcast, live cast, film, or television, the director is making choices about what the audience will see. Whereas in the theater, I find it much more, this is how it's collaborative with the audience. In the theater, the audience can look anywhere it wants. So it can look at the two people who are talking, or that character who's lurking behind the arras,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like the audience chooses. That's how it's participating in theater in a way that you don't with film. And with film, the director is pointing you at the thing he wants you to see, which is why there has to be that element of trust. So Catharsis, that I wrote for Tracy Napanak for PTE, I knew the actor. I was writing specifically for Tracy. I knew the director, Thomas Morgan Jones, who is a theater rat like me. He chose the filmmaker, and then he was responsible in the room for the way. And, you know, they had several back and forths, him and the filmmaker, on what was actually going to be shown. And again, it was not it was film, but it wasn't exactly film, because it was a film about theater, about returning to the theater. And so Thomas had a big hand in that. That is the biggest change for me. I don't write for film. I write for theater. And then I guess it would be interesting to see. You're right. Like, we get to see things. And we get to see this in Zoom land too, right?
Yeah.
We get to see things that we don't necessarily see when we're looking at a full stage. So that intimacy that you talk about, those moments. And it's a different kind of acting as well. We know that.
And when the film is edited, the final cut, the version that people watch and rewatch, you will see the lines delivered the exact same way, because that's the final cut. And that's the one thing that theater isn't, is that you never, ever are able to recapture. I was talking to Henry Wolfe about this. You can't recapture the live theater moment twice. It's lightning in a bottle. It's like a snowflake. Each performance will be influenced by a whole bunch of variables. But for myself, I think the death of my artistic sensibility would be once I committed to delivering a line one way for good and saying, there, for 8 shows a week, that's the way that line is going to be delivered. That's denying oneself the privilege of being an actor. Not to go so far that you throw off your fellow performers, but your live theater is a chance to find newness every time. And in a film, it's fixed. Once it's done, it's done.
Absolutely. And if you're any kind of an actor at all, stage actor, you continue to find things. And I'm going back to Keanu Reeves here for a moment, because I saw that show 3 times that he was in at MTC because I was working there and because I had friends in the company who were having to find their way with an actor who was not, who had not been a stage actor for a long time. He'd been a movie actor. But to his credit, between the last 2 shows, which was a matinee and an evening show, Keanu was in the shop kicking the door. He was so frustrated because he had not got it yet. Mm. And so I think that's a great thing too, that he continued to work through the process. And what he learned during the process was that he needed to work more. Yeah. And, you know, and that is the way theater is. So, I mean, it's not like he had never done theater. He had started in theater in Toronto. But then he went off and became a movie star. And then, so he came back and he discovered that it's not the same thing, that, you know, you have to keep working every night.
Yeah. I think you've found it, that intangible it as an artist, when they're lowering you into the ground, because up until that point, I just don't believe that you ever get to that point of saying, there, I finally found it. I've accomplished it. It's done. I have nowhere else to grow now. That's it. Done deal. Just give me the contract, because I found my moment. I've peaked.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to go back to the discussion about stunt for a moment in the time that we've got left. And this is opening up a bit of a can of worms, I realize, but we're in a time now more than ever, and there are theater companies, even in Saskatchewan, that are grappling with this, and all across Canada and hopefully around the world, that are dealing with diversity casting, making radical changes in how shows are cast. And my question to you is, how do you walk that? I don't mean how do you, but how does one walk that fine line between diversity casting? How does one walk that fine line between diversity casting and stunt casting? Because at some point it could appear to be a stunt. Oh, let's throw an Indigenous person into the role of Hamlet, which has been done. And look at that. Now we can see an Indigenous person play a traditionally non-Indigenous role. Ta-da! And scene, you know, which could be perceived as a stunt. It could also be, but it also is a gift to that Indigenous person to be able to finally be cast in something they would never have been considered for. So where's that line?
Well, you know, it has to be about, you know, this is why we're in this moment where people have to really examine why they're doing things. Like, you have to go to their heart and knock there and go, am I casting this Indigenous person because, I mean, first of all, if you just make a rule about it and start working within that rule, that will help. So here's a, for instance, Shortcuts Festival, which is a festival of 10-minute plays in Saskatoon that I started like 5 or 6 years ago, I guess. And I started it out of frustration because there weren't enough places for play. There wasn't enough opportunity for playwrights to practice. There weren't enough women directing for the stage. There weren't enough roles for women. There was just not enough. You know, I came from Toronto, which is really, really diverse, still has its problems, as we have seen through all of this. But to Saskatchewan, where it was just really, really white and male. So we started Shortcuts Festival. 10-minute plays, which is like a tiny little amount of time. It's, you know, it's low risk for artists, because if your 10-minute play doesn't fly, there's another one right around the corner that may be better. And, you know, in terms of artistic direction, we took care of the artists and we did development work and blah, blah, blah. But we just made rules at the beginning. We were like, it's going to be half and half men and women, directors, playwrights. There's always going to, the stage is always going to look like our community, which means it can't be all white. There have to be people of color, indigenous people on the stage. And there always has to be diversity in the plays. So there always, for me, as an indigenous artistic director, there always is going to be an indigenous play in the evening. And then once you've made rules, it's, you know, then you start finding the way to make that happen. So there have been years where I've had to bring in actors or find the play from outside Saskatchewan, the Indigenous play, because we don't have critical mass yet. But the rules are made, right? And we've had so many, you know, I approach young actors, women, and say, did you want to direct in Shortcuts this year? And they're like, oh, I've never directed. And I'm like, but I look at your resume and you've got like 9 assistant directings on there. So like, don't you think it's time? Do you want to try it? Like, it's 10 minutes. And that has made all the difference. Like, we've, you know, you don't have to love it, but some people do. Like, Anita Smith came through Shortcuts. And she was like, she's directed a couple. And then she's like, okay, I'm going off to direct at Shakespeare on the Saskatchewan and at, you know, Persephone. Like, sometimes it's just the opportunity that opens up the idea for everyone. So that's thing one. Don't make it a stunt. Make it a rule. There's like, you know, it's going to be challenging for theaters here because we drive away artists of color. Because they can't get work, because they're not, so far, they're not being seen as just an actor. They're being seen as a Black actor or an Asian actor or whatever. So they go to Toronto or they go to Vancouver, where there's way more work and there's way more opportunity for them. But what does that do to us here? It impoverishes us because we just keep perpetuating the whiteness on our stages.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
Yeah. But I would call a spade at this point and go, yeah, but there may be more opportunity in Toronto and Vancouver. But I still think that that same systemic issue exists across the board for all theater companies. And I still think a Black actor will find themselves in an audition room where there's a director thinking, well, I'm not really feeling casting this role as a person of color. And thank you. It was good to hear your work. And you know darn well when you walk away that you've been seen as other. And I think, sadly, that will exist until the directors change, until the producers change, until the theater companies change. And to hell whether the audience perceives it as a stunt, the director says, I'm not interested in going down that route anymore. And it's an agreement on behalf of all of the powers that be, that's just the route that they're going to go.
Yes, agreed. I agree with everything you say, but it's just, but now we're in the moment. We are in the moment. So you said it, change. Let's change the director then. Let's change the people at the head of the theaters. Let's change them. If they can't, you know, they've had all of this time to make change and they haven't been able to do it, so let's change them. You know, there's, you know, Jennifer Bruin's in at the Globe, so there's change happening there. She comes with a sensitivity to the challenges that mainstream theater face in this country. So there will be change there. Persephone is looking for, you know, trying to figure out what it's going to do in terms of its leadership. There will be change there. It's time. Let's just change the rules.
Yeah.
It's possible because Shortcuts does it. Some theater does it. Like, we do it. So it's possible. We've gone this, like, just look around you. These are companies that never are all white. It is possible.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I guess if the critics, if the public, if the, you know, if people choose to see it as a stunt when it is coming from a place of honesty behind the scenes, well, you know, screw them, really. I mean, you really can't control public perception and critic perception. If you're coming from a place of honesty in your casting, that's what matters most. And the rest of the world will come along for a ride when it just becomes the norm, when it's no longer a, interesting choice. Never seen that done before. That it just becomes a non-conversation.
So, speaking of being in the moment, you've shared some really powerful insights with me on this crazy world we call theater and the influences in your life. So, in that same spirit of being in the moment, let me ask you, at the end of your life, how would you like to be remembered? In other words, complete the sentence. Yvette Nolan, she was...
She was kind.
Again, generosity.
Yeah.
Spirit of generosity runs through you.
I got it from my mother.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's a nice note to end on. I love these conversations. I do appreciate you hanging out with me.
Yes, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Yeah. Let's do it again sometime.
Let us do it again sometime. That would be great.
Thank you, Yvette.
Thank you, Kevin.
The Saskapes podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported in part by Kinexus. So, the next time you're stuck in traffic for a while, here's some things to think about instead of why is the car in front of you going so slow? Or if the car behind you is trying to hitch a ride on your bumper? What if your bank was committed to working with you to achieve your goals? And what if they cared enough to get to know you? And what if they weren't successful until you were? And what if your financial well-being drove everything they did? So come see why things are different at Kinexus. Stop by any branch to learn more about how Kinexus cares. Direct West is a proud sponsor of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. So is marketing getting in the way of running your business? Things like updating your Google listing, thinking of a headline for a billboard, or making sure your website is in good shape. That's where Direct West comes in. You can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com.
Hey, thanks for listening. Music for Saskapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. Saskapes can be downloaded from iTunes, Google Play, the Saskapes app for Android devices, and all of the other major podcasting apps. Stop by and say hi to us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Saskapes. I'd really appreciate it if you stop by iTunes and give us a review or star rating. That boosts the podcast series in the rankings and more people get to hear your stories. Now, if you know an individual, a group, a town that has a story to tell, I'd love to hear from you. Contact me and I'll let you know what's involved in sponsoring your own episode of Saskapes. There's no shortage of stories to be told here under the land of the living skies. So until next time...